Welcome to Demystifying Franchise Ownership, the podcast that brings you expert advice, transparency, and clarity around franchise ownership. Whether you are a prospective or current franchisee or franchisor, or simply curious about the topic, say hello to your host, Christine Givens.
Welcome back to Demystifying Franchise Ownership, where I share my knowledge, experience, and hard-earned lessons learned about franchise ownership. If you're thinking about investing in a franchise concept that operates out of a brick and mortar, you don't want to skip this episode. My guest today, Karen Abrams, is an attorney and head of the commercial leasing practice at Paris Ackerman. Another podcast guest, Meg Schmitz, introduced Karen to me, and Meg described Karen as the attorney you want representing you when you're leasing commercial real estate. I can't recall the exact word she used for you, but it was something like tiger or ferocious. I could have used you when I was entered into my commercial lease. So anyway, welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here. Love talking about this. So looking forward to it.
What you do.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So tell the listeners how long you've been working in the franchise world.
So I've been practicing law for, next year will be 30 years. Yikes. And the overwhelming majority of that has been working on commercial lease negotiations, representing franchisees, largely representing franchisees on letters of intent, lease negotiations, entity formations. And I mean, I do represent some business owners who are not in the franchise realm, but it is overwhelmingly franchise operators. Yeah.
What led you to this practice area?
I kind of fell into it by accident a little bit. I mean, this is going back many, many, many years when I was a younger attorney who didn't really have any business. And I was trying to think of unique ways to get some new clients. And I had gone to a franchise trade show at the Jacob Javits Center. I think it was like $5 to get in. And there were hundreds. Yeah, there were hundreds of franchise operators, franchisors. You know, they all have booths. They're, I mean, the primary person who attends these conferences are typically people who are looking to open a franchise, and they're doing their investigating. They want to speak to people. So I decided to go. I walked around. Thankfully, I'm fairly chatty and, you know, comfortable walking up to strangers. And I would just kind of go booth to booth and talk to different brands about what is your process when you have a franchisee who has identified real estate, and how can I start to work with them? Because I had already had experience in the commercial real estate leasing industry, but I hadn't done a lot of work representing franchisees. And I really connected with one brand. The real estate director and I really connected, hit it off. He started giving my name to several of their franchisees, and it just sort of snowballed from there. I started working a lot with that brand. And then, you know, people talk, people have friends, people have connections. You work with brokers, and thankfully, knock on wood, I guess I've done a pretty decent job. And thankfully, I get a lot of referrals.
Well, usually if you get referrals, that means you're doing a great job. That's how it works, right?
Yeah.
I know that you, in talking with you before we recorded, you were also a franchisee yourself. Tell the listeners about your experience as a franchisee. What did you enjoy about it? What did you not like about it?
So I am actually still a franchise owner today. So my franchise ownership kind of also stemmed, funny enough, out of that conference. I went to this conference. As I said, I met with one brand. And as I started representing a lot of franchisees from that brand, I was also, maybe you could say, going through kind of an early midlife crisis. And I was like, I don't know if I want to be a lawyer forever. What can I do to exit that and still make a living? And I thought, you know, I'm representing a lot of people who are opening franchises, opening businesses, and I'm very intrigued by that. So I decided to open my own franchise, and I actually wound up opening within, I think I went from zero locations to three in like 8 months. I had two locations that I opened in two totally unrelated industries, one in the food industry and one in the hair care industry. Two locations that I opened within a few months of each other. I want to say a few weeks, maybe a few months. And then I wound up buying another location from someone else. So I went from zero locations to three within just a few months, which was a little crazy given that I had no franchise experience at all. But as I've learned with the clients I represent, that doesn't necessarily stop people. And I had a very interesting experience. You know, I had two stores that I was running on my own. I had one store that I was running with a business partner. I had two stores that I built from the ground up. I had one that I wound up buying from an existing owner. And in my experience, I have sadly or happily or however you want to look at it, experienced everything that my clients go through every day in that, like I said, I negotiated leases. I bought an existing location. I wound up selling those. I'm in other brands today, but so I've sold locations. One of my franchises, sadly, this is the sadly part, was very unsuccessful, kind of from day two. And that was sort of a tragic personal experience, but thank God I came through it okay, though I did lose a very significant amount of money. But all of that, you know, buying existing businesses, starting existing businesses, having partners, doing them on my own, taking out SBA loans, succeeding, failing, defaulting, all of it has absolutely shaped me into the attorney that I am today, because I have a very different perspective when I represent my clients, because I am still a franchise owner. Today, the brands that I own are more, I have more of an investment role, and I'm not involved in the day-to-day, which, given that I'm still practicing full-time and clearly did not follow through on my pursuit of exiting the practice of law, I think is a good thing for me that today I'm just an investor.
Was there one thing you really enjoyed about being a franchisee?
Yeah, I really enjoy having opportunities to interact with the customers. I mean, I interact every day with my law clients, but that's a very different animal than the customers who patronize the franchise businesses. So I love having that hands-on experience, being in the store. Sometimes it's nice to get the personal benefit. You know, I had a hair salon, so I could get my hair blown out. I had a restaurant to get my food anytime I wanted. But I really enjoyed interacting with the customers, talking to them, getting their feedback, their thoughts on what they like, what they didn't like. I just like talking to people. So I always really enjoyed that perspective.
Were you buying or investing in any of these franchises with the thought that they would be semi-absentee, where you could continue with your law practice and you know, run this kind of on the side? Or did you go into it knowing you were going to spend most of your time working in the franchises?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of franchises advertise themselves as being very hands-off. And that is possible. I think that that is more possible and a more successful business model for people who own many locations, such that they're generating enough money and can afford to hire middle management between them and the employees and the customers. If you only, you know, I never got to that point. So I was managing every minute, every day to day. I was doing the weekly schedule for my staff every day. I mean, I did have managers, but because I didn't own the business, you know, I only owned these particular businesses for a few years. So I never really reached a point that I got to be as hands-off as I wanted to be. And the truth is, whether you own one location or two or five or 10 or 20, there's never going to be someone who cares as much about your business as you do. So you can never really be totally hands-off in any business, in any industry. So to answer your question, I found that I needed to be very hands-on. But again, I also would say that that was in large part because I never reached the level of ownership where I could afford to be more hands-off. So
yeah. And it's funny that you say that, because I'm trying to remember who exactly said that. In this week, someone else said that exact same thing to me about being semi-absentee. Like, you really, until you get to that, at a certain level where you can share resources, you know, amongst the, it really is hard to leverage your time and all that. And to your point, no one will ever care about it as much as you do. Even if,
Absolutely.
If you get to that point where you own 10, okay, maybe you're not working in the day-to-day operations, but you're probably working at a higher level on your business.
You should be. I mean, you should be. Like, you should never be so completely hands-off that you don't really know what's going on. If you're lucky and you're a multi-unit owner and you get a great manager, because I always say this to my clients, it's all about the manager. Like, getting a great manager who is really vested in the success of the business, which is why I always tell people, find a great manager and treat them very well if you do, because they're hard to come by. You know, then you get an opportunity to maybe be hands-off on some of the day-to-day. For example, you don't have to deal with employees calling out sick or, you know, kind of standard ordinary customer complaints. But then the things you're working on are at a higher level. Maybe you're focusing more on marketing or, you know, who knows what, but you certainly do get the economies of scale and maybe the opportunity to share employees, but it's all about the management. It's all about the management and hopefully getting your business to a point that you're making enough money from one or multiple locations that you can justify the expense of having a great manager.
One of my other guests, he owns 37 Great Clips.
Wow.
And they happen to find someone who's working behind the chair who they just saw some special skills in. And I think this was early on in their trajectory. I'm not sure though. And they took this individual really, they saw something special in her and were able to help her become this, I think she's sort of the manager of their brand basically. And like a COO. And those are the people you need to cherry pick, see the potential and really make the most of it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When you've mentioned that you do lease negotiations, you review LOIs, all those things. Tell us how you typically work with a client. What's the process when you have a franchisee who is looking at a particular space?
So people typically call me after they've identified a space when they're either mid LOI negotiation. Sometimes they call me when they're done with their letters of intent. I'm not typically as involved in letters of intent, candidly, as I would like to be. I always tell my clients, be careful and be smart when you're reviewing and negotiating your letter of intent, because even though it is not binding, the letter of intent is absolutely intended to be a good faith statement of where this deal is going to go. And if the letter of intent says rent is $100 a month, then you shouldn't think that, well, okay, when I get to the lease, I'm going to tell them I really only want to pay $95 a month, because that's not going to be received by them, just as it wouldn't be well received by you if they turned around and said, we meant $105. So I love getting involved at the letter of intent stage, typically, or I wouldn't say typically, but more often than not, I'm not. So people send me their letter of intent. They send me their lease. We do a full review of the lease from start to finish. We're reading the whole document. We prepare a proposed redraft that we're going to send back to the landlord. But before I send it to the landlord, I send it first to the client. And I really like to go through it in detail with my client. And I always tell them, I'll go through it with you in whatever manner or capacity works for you. If you want to go through it by phone, great. If email's better, that's fine. Most people seem to prefer email. But we really like to go through, we call them our client comments. And a lot of those client comments are me flagging things for my clients, because I think a lot of people have never signed a retail lease before. So I'm pointing things out to them that may be very obvious to me and may be very typical and may be very standard, that pretty much every retail tenant has to have a maintenance agreement on their HVAC system. But if you've never owned a business before, you don't know what that is, or even that you have to have one. So I feel like it's my responsibility as I'm going through the lease to say, hey, client, FYI, you have to have a maintenance agreement on your air conditioning system. FYI, here is the language that your signage company is going to need when they do draft drawings for your signage. Please forward this to them. FYI, here's the amount of insurance you have to carry. Send this to your insurance company. Here's the landlord's work exhibit. And please be aware that anything that's not on this exhibit, is your responsibility. So make sure you go through this exhibit with your contractor so that everyone is clear what is being done by the landlord and by exclusion, what's not being done and therefore what you're doing. I just feel like it's my job to go through everything with them on the assumption that they don't understand the lease. And I always tell my clients, you need to read the lease, but I'm aware that most of them don't. So I feel like it's my job to be their lawyer, but also hold their hand and be their teacher and make sure they understand what they're signing. So after I send it to them, I go through it with them, like I said, by phone or by email or some combination of both. And then after that, I send the comments back to the landlord. We usually have, you know, a couple of rounds of back and forth with the landlord by email. And then I really like to get everyone on a call. Email is great. I'm a big, big fan of email, but email is not typically what gets things done at the end of the day. So a lot of conference calls, but always holding the client's hand to make sure, like I said, that they understand what they're signing. I want them to understand what happens someday when they sell the business. You know, are they going to be, do they need the landlord's consent if they want to sell the business? And what are they released from liability? Huge question. Something that most of my clients don't even think about. And I might say to them, you know, FYI, your lease says that when you sell the business, you are not released from liability. And they're like, what are you talking about? I would never agree to that, even though that's a very standard landlord position. So, you know, again, that's why I feel that it's very much my responsibility to explain those things to my clients. So
have you found with the, I'll call them market disruptions in the commercial real estate market with people doing more e-commerce and people working at home more, things like that, have they made lease negotiations easier? Are there more, is there more space available? Can you talk about that? Or have these things not yet really impacted the market?
So COVID was a very, you know, earth-shattering thing in every sense for everyone. For someone who does what I do, initially, it was, I hate to say it was amazing because it was such a horrible disease, but no one was leasing space. So I could ask for anything I wanted and I got it because no one was signing leases. And when I had a few clients who were willing to sign a lease, we could say to the landlord, well, you know, we'll sign the lease, but you know, we want the right to terminate the lease, you know, or we could ask for things that you would never normally ask for, that landlords would never have even contemplated giving. And they did because they were just so happy to have people signing leases. Today, I will say, I find it to have very much shifted. Like all the things I was asking for and getting fairly easily during COVID, not only am I not getting anymore, I don't even ask for most of them anymore because it's just kind of a non-starter. Like we were able to say things like, you know, if there's ever any other sort of pandemic, epidemic, force majeure, anything like that, we don't pay rent. Right. Because during COVID, that was the big thing. People had to close and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of lease modifications to address what happened. Some landlords were great. A lot of landlords were great in working with their tenants. Some of them abated the rent completely. Some of them deferred the rent. You know, you don't have to pay the rent now, but you're going to take 3 months of rent and you're going to pay it to me over the next 2 years, whatever the case may be. And some landlords weren't so great, but thankfully that was a smaller percentage. But all of those things that I could ask for, like I said, they're just not standard protocol to ask for them today. And I will say that not only is that the case, but people are raring to go opening new businesses again. So that does make it a little bit more, maybe a lot more of a landlord's market today. So I still negotiate as hard. I'm just not always as successful as I was
before. So you're finding all over, or is it really depend geographically where you are, that there is a tightening of the commercial real estate market, or does it really depend on where you are?
I think it does depend on where you are. And I don't know if I would call it a tightening.
Higher demand?
I mean, it's absolutely a supply and demand, right? I'm seeing, you know, for example, a lot of people during COVID got dogs, right? Myself included. I had two dogs, now I have three. So a lot of people got dogs, and now doggy daycare businesses are booming. And I work with a lot of them, and they're crushing it. Oh my gosh, are they crushing it? You know, so it had that effect, but there is a much higher demand, and it is a supply and demand industry for sure. For sure. So all these people who are ready to get back into the world of starting businesses makes it a little bit more of a landlord market.
Do almost all of the leases that you look at have a personal guarantee?
Yes, very, very much so. I tell my clients that it's pretty much a given that you're going to sign a personal guarantee. You know, unless
Tell
you
the
are.
listeners what that means. Tell the listeners what that
So
means.
what that means is when you sign a lease, odds are that you will be forming a new single per SPE, single purpose entity. Single purpose entity means I'm opening, you know, whatever, a Dunkin' Donuts on Main Street in any town USA. It's my very first location, and maybe I'm forming Karen's Donuts LLC. That entity is a brand new entity. That entity has no assets at all other than this business. And because of that, if the business fails or if I default and the landlord tries to sue my LLC, they know that their odds of collecting are slim. So a personal guarantee is an assurance to the landlord that they have someone else to sue, someone else to collect from if the business is not doing well. So the landlord will say, yes, I want Karen's Donuts LLC on the lease, but I also want Karen as the guarantor. And if Karen is married, I want Karen's spouse as well. Even if Karen's spouse, this is such an important point because my clients always say to me, well, my spouse has nothing to do with the business. They're not going to sign the personal guarantee. Most of the time, yes, they are. Because the landlord's thought is, I don't want Karen to take all of her assets and put them in her spouse's name so that someday if I have to come after Karen, she's like, oops, sorry, I don't have anything. Everything's in my spouse's name. So the personal guarantee is the landlord's way of making sure they have someone else, something else to go after to collect when and if the time comes. And let's say I were to open a second location. I could use Karen's Donuts LLC again. The majority of my clients wind up forming separate entities for each location. So it might be Karen's Donuts 2 LLC or, you know, whatever creative name, and people get to be very creative when they name their LLCs. But I am a fan of separate entities for each location. I have clients who have 100 locations and they have 100 entities, which certainly can be an administrative nightmare. But then again, when you have 100 locations, you typically have an accountant handling all the day-to-day for you, and you're not dealing with paying your bills or those headaches. But I am a fan of keeping that liability very limited like that. I have other clients who, as they grow and grow and grow, keep everything under one entity. If that's the case, and you have an entity that owns multiple businesses and you have some real assets in that entity, that's the rare situation where you might get away without a personal guarantee because you're giving them a tenant who has money. 99.9% of the leases I work on do have a personal guarantee. Sometimes it goes away after a period of time. I mean, there's ways to negotiate it, but yes, you're almost always starting off with something.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if my lease, I think my personal guarantee did not go away after, you know, any, I think it was on, you know, through the lease term.
Yeah, so sometimes it goes away, sometimes it doesn't go away, but it becomes more limited after a certain period of time. And then, of course, as I said, the question is what happens to your guarantee someday when you sell the business? You know, all of those things are things to think about. But yes, the personal guarantee is definitely one of the, I would say one of the most important provisions in any lease. And my clients often don't really get it. So what that means. And so I actually feel like it's my job. And for people who wonder, well, what does that mean? Does that mean there's going to be a mortgage on my house? It is never. Very rarely is the personal guarantee secured. So it doesn't mean that they can come and take your house, but it does mean that they can get a judgment against you. So
that wraps up part one of my conversation with Karen Abrams. Karen and I will continue our conversation in next week's episode, where we cover what impacts the pricing of commercial space, whether you can renegotiate your lease. Is it common for the terms of your lease and franchise agreement to be completely aligned? And why it's so critical to have an attorney review your lease agreement? You'll find Karen's contact information in the show notes. Don't hesitate to reach out to me via email by going to the contact page on my website, christinegibbons.com. If you're currently evaluating a franchise system, make sure to get my guide called The Ultimate Step-by-Step Guide to Vetting and Evaluating a Franchise Opportunity. You'll also find that resource on my website. As always, tune in next week, and thanks for listening.